for me, it's key in life and realizing that there's only one person who's going to get you out of this hole, and that's you.
Yeah. Bear Grylls, actually, to my face, called me mental for doing this. I met him when I was in the Marines. He's honorary colonel in the Marines. Yeah, wow. He's read the books, sent me an email the other week. Yeah, I was in hospital. I dragged myself into hospital and should have died. I went to hospital a few times because it got that bad.
Don't just talk it, walk it.
There's a couple of boys from Twin Town, this is.
Classic. I know every single word of that film.
Do you?
Oh, yeah. My mate from Tramface, we used to recite it.
Did you? I played in boys club when we were younger. Welsh boys club it was called. And like every bus trip going anywhere, it was Twin Town on. It's class, though, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah, brilliant. You can watch it over and over again because it's just still funny and.
It is, man. Yeah. Well, Lee West, brother, mate, done a nice travel up you.
Yeah,
mate. I just want to say now before we start, like it's. I've been doing a lot of I'm doing as much research as I can on you, mate. But if I did as much research as I can on you, I think I'd be you for another couple of years. Just all of the experiences, everything that you've done, mate. It's a credit to you, and it's actually like the more I think about it, I did the workout today called Murph. Have you heard
no,
Murph?
Yeah,
so what area he's in, but he was in the army or Marines or Navy in America, but he died. So they did a workout in memory of him called Murph. So it's 1 mile run with a weighted 20 kg weighted vest on 1 mile run, 100 push-ups, 100 pull-ups, 200 push-ups, 300 air squats with a weighted vest on, 1 mile run, and come back, and that's it.
I don't think I could have done that when I was in the Marines, never mind now.
So I did it today, but I was thinking about it today, all of the work you've done. And it's some admiration to you, because there's people out there every day that, you know, I can't do this because of this, I can't do that because of this. And even down to the charity work you've done, it's like, well, you if anyone listened to anything you've done, like you'd spring out of bed purely from what you've done, and actions speak louder than words, right?
Yeah.
And you're definitely an action man.
Cheers, man. Appreciate that. Because it may seem weird for people to hear me say that with all the stuff that we have done, to me, it becomes normalized. So a lot of the time when I'm talking about it, I'm like, oh, am I boring people with this? People are like, you're not, because to me, it's quite normal. But to a lot of other people, it's completely the opposite.
Yeah, well, even you know, top it off, you're Welsh, to top it off, so I'm happy.
Top of the tree.
Swansea boy. Where in Swansea?
I grew up in a place called Town Hill. Which is notorious at the time. It was the biggest town council estate in Wales.
Really?
Obviously a very deprived area. Thing is, I grew up, it's funny, because if you walked up my road, you're in Town Hill. It's a very notoriously rough area. No-go area, some people might say, in the 80s, 90s. Car crime, at one point it was the car crime capital of the UK. But if you walk down my road, you're in a place called Cockett.
Right.
Which is the complete opposite. Leafy, quite settled, and I wouldn't say posh, but a big step up from Town Hill. But I could never win because my postcode was actually Cockett.
Yeah.
But you just class yourself as a Town Hill boy. That's the circles you were in. But if you're in town talking to a girl, and she said, where are you from? You say, oh, Cockett, obviously.
Yeah.
But if the lads heard, you'd be like, no, he's not. He's from Town Hill. Stop. Who do you think you are? Then if you're talking to a bunch of lads, give it a big time, you're like, yeah, I'm from Town Hill. The lads like, no, he's not. He's a Cockett pansy.
So it's a change of the, depending on who you're talking to.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I'm from Bridgend, and we're always called townies. And to the Valley boys, we're always known as soft.
Yeah.
But then to the anyone else, like City boys or anything else, we're... We're the rough ones, probably. Just bring that mic a little bit closer. If you grab a ear and just pull it in, it'll come over.
Got it?
Yeah, that's all perfect. Right. Yeah, that's perfect. So, man, first and foremost for you now, 17 years. I want to get it all right at the start now. So, 17 years in the Royal Marines Commandos.
Correct.
Special Force.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've done 4 tours of Iraq and Afghan.
Yeah.
3 books out, is that right?
4 books.
4 on the way?
Four out.
So you're doing the audio for the last?
Doing the audio for the most recent one, and then I'll start doing the audio for the other 3 as well.
Charities you've done? You've got 1 charity? Or?
Yeah, so I'm founder and trustee of a charity called Salute. Mm. Spelled SA1, postcode of Swansea, UTE, so Salute.
Yeah, wow. Anything else? I know there's a load of other things, but any other titles I've got to cover before?
I did a bit of a football coaching quals a few years back. I own a business in Swansea.
Pub in Swansea, right?
Yeah, yeah, cafe, bar.
Nice.
Professional bicycle mechanic.
Yeah, I heard that.
Just throwing them out there now.
Well, mate, you've done a lot, and you know, I credit you 17 years in a career which is very taxing. You got to devote your life to something like that and shed a lot of skin, which you have done. When I think about that, though, you know, coming from a council estate, essentially, then is this the journey you always wanted to go through, or was it like, or is it just like kind of fell into this?
Yeah, it did. It has panned out how. Wouldn't say exactly as you dream of when you're younger, because I would have been a professional footballer, like all lads who played football to a decent level when they're younger did. But I started reading books when I was younger, which the book thing has tied into that dream when I was young. We're talking sort of young teenage up to 20, 21. Started to read military books, and still to this day I preferred reading biographical ones. True stories. I couldn't really get into the fiction ones. I've read a few over the years, the ones that become famous and are entertaining. But I generally switch off because in my head it's just like, well, this isn't real. Somebody's made this up.
That's the same as me.
So I read a lot of military books. So that sort of geared me towards my interest in the military. Mm. And of course, then you read a lot about the Royal Marines and the paratroopers, the more elite units that you can join. And it started push me in that way. So I loved reading the books and I loved the adventures that these guys had gone on. And a lot of the time in the books you read, they did come from a background like me.
Yeah.
They come from poor areas. I didn't come from a broken home or any abuse or anything like that. A lot of them did, but I did come from a poor background, council estate. So it was great reading these books thinking, well, they've gone on and led this life full of adventure and written books about it. Well, there's nothing stopping me doing it. Mm. So it is a direct correlation between my teenage years with where I am now. Yeah. And a lot of other stuff that got thrown in along the way as well.
Is there a moment, right, when you're in the Marines where you go, this is me? Like, is it a pivotal moment when you started, or when you did the training camp at the start? Or was it like, you know, your first tour where you go, you don't actually know if you're cut out for this until you're in the moment?
Mm. That comes into different things about how you fit into it along your career, but for the initial part of it, we said the feeling, this is for me and a belonging and this is what I want. It was from the start for me. Really? I was 22 when I applied, so older than a lot of the ads. Not unusual. They were in the Marines. We do tend to have guys who've maybe been in the army before and they leave and then they join the Marines. They're a bit older, a bit more mature, and I think when I joined, the upper age limit was 32. You could join up until you were 32. Mm. But I was older than the majority of the lads joining in their late teenage years. And that was good for me because rather than just coming from school, going straight into the Marines and going, oh, there's a golden ticket on the outside. I can go and get a nice job. I can be home in my bed every night.
Yeah.
Which a lot of the younger lads do. They don't see that, the vision of how good your career and your adventure could be. They see the now. This is hard work. This is miserable. There must be something better on the outside. And I'd seen the outside. I worked in a warehouse when I left school. Didn't have any qualifications. I just had to leave school and go to work. I then got a job in the DVLA as a civil servant, which for somebody who was unskilled without qualifications was a comfortable job. But I'd seen enough of the civilian side of life. Mm. I joined the TA, Territorial Army, to get a feel for the military. Well, let's weigh it up then to see, do I fit them and does it fit me? So I did that. So I felt I was able to make a more measured decision at 22 to go into it, which I did. And that helped when I got there, when the chips were down and it was getting tough. Well, I was in my mind, well, I've made this decision. It's a measured, it's not a knee jerk. I want to do this and I want the life it's going to give, and it's going to be hard. But in my mind was, this, I've made this choice and I'm going to see it through. So from the start for me, it was like just, I've made this decision. I know it's going to be hard, but I want the rewards that I know it's going to give me, because it did suit my mentality.
Wow. Is this something in the Marines, essentially, that, or, you know, being in the military, there's always something that, being myself a sports rugby player most of my life, there's always some form of, right, always wanting to essentially your coach is someone you want to please. Like for me, it was always wanting to do enough for my parents, make them proud. But actually, like this guy was giving me tough love for so long, that you know you're willing to just do anything to do, you know, do right in their eyes and be the best version as you can be in the military or in the, you know, in the Marines. Was that a similar concept with you, or was it just something like, I've always been a driven bloke and this is how I just run my, you know?
No, 100%. I haven't really spoken about that before, so it's a really good question. There was definitely that. We had a corporal, he's called Paps, I'll call him, I'll give his real name away. He was Scottish, very uncompromising, tough, but above all, professional. You could see when he was being tough on us and putting us through the mill, he wasn't just doing it because he was nasty and he enjoyed people in pain. He had high standards and professional levels, and he loved the Marines. And he wanted the people that he was in control of training who were going to join the Marines. And well, I actually passed out and did a sniper course alongside him on the same course, sleeping in the same room, which was bizarre. And obviously, that's because it is a small-knit community. They're like, well, they're not just going to train these blokes and never see him again, so I can just bully him, do what I want. Well, they're going to be working alongside me. They're going to be my lads. I'm going to potentially take them to war. And he had that professional level, which I could see. He wasn't just putting us through the mill for the sake of it. And I really looked up to that, respected it, and I wanted to be like him.
Of course.
And when we were on exercise, and I was tired, wet, hungry, and thinking about quitting, not quitting the Marines, but just doing stuff half-heartedly, we had a saying within my little team was, what would Paps do?
Yeah.
And you just say to yourself, well, what would he do in this situation if he was tired and he wanted to just cut corners? Well, he wouldn't. He'd do it properly. And that's what we said to ourselves, because we wanted to emulate the example he'd set to us. And that was not only brilliant for me in that, that was brilliant for the guys that when I was Paps years later as a corporal training the new recruits, I took all, and I tried to do this in every leadership and command role that I had. I took all the best things that I learned from him and all the worst things I saw from the other instructors, because there were some, I mean, not completely bad, but sometimes we just think, that's not the best way to treat us or to get that across. And I was able to take all the best and the worst from these guys I'd experienced. And when I was training my recruits, and then I went on to train corporals when I was a sergeant, you take everything, right? You don't just take the good, you take all the bad things you saw. And say, well, I'm not going to be, because when I was in that position, I hated him for that.
Of course.
Because I knew it was not just because he was punishing me. I knew it was the wrong way to do it.
Yeah.
So you're like, well, I'm not going to do that when I'm in this position. So, yeah, exactly the same as you've said with your coach and someone. And then it goes on. You leave training. It doesn't just end there. There's always going to be somebody to look up to.
Someone to look up to,
When you go there, you go to your unit, your sergeant. You get a good one, you get a not-so-good one. And, yeah, you want to impress them. You want to be part of that team. And you've got it. Yeah, you identify which are the good traits and which are the bad ones, and then that helps you to develop your own standards.
Wow, it's just really interesting from my end, because obviously the different, totally different industries, but there's so many common traits in you know men calling it a brotherhood or call it whatever you want, but when you shed skin with each other as well, right? It's like you go through some adversities together. It just brings you closer. You know, good times are amazing, but good times are brought together from tough times.
Yeah, definitely.
And you won't understand that until you experience it. And you know who's there for you as well, right? Has there ever been a moment where, you know, if it was in the training or if it was on a one tour in particular, that you remember something comes to be where, you know, you've heard something on the radio, like something, bullets being shot or this has been shot, and just the response from your team, who does what in certain situations? Like, was it flight or fight mode? Is it?
Yeah, flight or fight or freeze.
Or freeze, well. Yeah.
See, the name of one of my chapters in my book, actually. fight, flight or freeze.
Yeah. And is there any moments you can reflect on in that way? You like, because you don't know until you're in that situation, right?
Definitely, and it's different forms of it. If something's happened, I remember one instance in particular, like you said, that was, we were in Afghanistan, Helmand, a place called Zumbale. We were in contact with the enemy. It turned out to be a 6-hour firefight, it turned out to be. we were on the forward elements and we started to receive mortar fire. So they were dropping bombs on us, the Taliban, and we were intercepting their communication as well. And they were doing something known as creeping it or rolling thunder. They were dropping the bombs, for to use a crude term so everyone can understand, mortar bombs, forward of us, and then just adjusting slowly and just bringing it and watching where it was landing so they could just bring it closer and closer to us.
Wow.
So we identified this, passed it back to our support team, which were up on a high feature behind us. And I heard a voice come back on the radio. It was a guy called Nick, and he was the instructor when I did a sniper's course. And he was what I would describe as a mega sniper. He was just meticulous. He was gifted and talented, actually, as a sniper, but it's not just that. He researched all different weapons, everything. He knew everything about it. And as soon as I heard his voice come back saying that he was locating where they were firing from, so then he could get a grid, pass it to our mortar team, I thought, that's it, job done, we're safe, because he's going to locate where they are, he's gonna pass that on, and we're going to drop them. And it did. He called in one bomb, so he gave the grid of where he thought it was. He called in one of our bombs, and then all I heard was, adjust 50 metres left.
Wow.
What, 50 metres left, bomb went up and landed straight on where they were firing that's from. Yeah, so it's different people who's got different skills. It gives you that. Well, as soon as I heard his voice, I thought, we're safe now.
Yeah, yeah.
He's going to sort this out.
Like, again, it's like from such a, like a civvy. I'm a civvy, right? That's what I am. Yeah, we are the civvy background.
I don't use the term a lot. It's more of an army term.
Yeah,
that one,
okay,
yeah.
Okay. Well, are you?
I'm a civvy. I'm a civvy as well now.
But you've got a different background to me. Yeah. But, you know, experiencing that and understanding as well, like you said, he was just meticulous about being a sniper. Like, he knew, like, he was more gifted than the average person. So, like, in life, right, we all have certain things we're naturally more gifted on than the other person. Yeah. You might be a really good communicator. Mm-hmm. This guy could practice his communication all his life, but unfortunately, he's just not got that gift. What would you say was your natural gift that, you know, you worked on the most or enhanced?
Tough one. It's hard now, isn't it? Because I can't big myself up and go, oh yeah, I was brilliant at this naturally. I wasn't the most gifted, and I knew when I was in training, I passed out with the King's Badge, so I had the best, the award for the best all-round recruit at the end. I won the fittest, I won strongest mentally or physically. I wasn't the most gifted, talented in the Marines. It was just, the reason I got that was the voice in my head saying, when it did get tough, you're here for the long haul. And I think one of the things I prided myself on was in my leadership, and is a quote in my book, which some I came up with it where I did a leadership talk for HSBC managers.
Wow.
And I thought, I'm going to have to come up with my own quote now on leadership after doing this speech. And it goes, the first steps to being a great leader are simple. Be honest and be yourself.
I've seen this.
Because nobody's going to follow a fraud into battle, no matter how good you pretend to be. And that's what I lived by. In all my leadership command roles, you have to put on a persona because you have to tell people what to do.
Yeah.
And it's important because actually, lives could be in danger. But I always try and put my own personality on it, because if the lads just see me being me as they are around, and then suddenly when I'm commanded, I'm leading them, I just turn into this robot just going by the book, they're going to go, where's that come from? Who's he trying to be? And you're not gonna fool them. So, yeah, I always put my personality on everything, because then it'd be natural.
Yeah.
Like, well, he's just being who he is. He's Westy. But just to be a bit more authoritative now, because he's in charge and he's telling us what to do. I wasn't the best at shooting a rifle. I was really good with the pistol. I just think that level-headedness of being able to just not get too flustered, not get too angry, because a lot of times we are angry and just go, right, well, let's think about this for a second. Let's just not fly off the handle. And just have that ability just to step back and be a bit more measured about things.
Well, I think you're really humble in everything you said there, and I'm probably a bit selfless, and I understand, I can tell, you know, everything you've done, mate. I think your actions, your if you looked at, you know, if you went on Wikipedia or seen whatever you've done, everything you've done, mate, I think you're more exceptional than the average person, but adding a lot of hard work to that as well. Mate, like, if you think about it, you know, more and more, for instance, there was times, you know, I looked up at, you got kidnapped, is that right, by the Al-Qaeda?
Hence why I'm still sat here now, and I wasn't on Al Jazeera in an orange boiler suit, but it was an attempted kidnap. Yeah.
Attempted, sorry. Yeah. How did that experience, or how did this all like map out? Where did it start from?
Yeah, so we were in Baghdad, Iraq, 2006. We were part of a specialist unit, and myself and a paratrooper, we were a troop of Marines attached to a more specialist unit, is all I'll say. And we were in Baghdad on kill and capture for the layman. We were there. We weren't there to patrol or guard parts of ground or mundane ground holding tasks. We were there in our base. As soon as intelligence told us that Abu Musab Zarqawi, for instance, who was the head of Al-Qaeda at the time, we weren't involved in his demise during that tour. And one of these top leaders, we would have high value targets, not gunmen and pipe swingers. When one of them was around and identified, we get in a helicopter or get in a Humvee and we go out and get them. Which was great. I said Humvees because the British weren't actively patrolling Baghdad. It was the American zone. So we were dressed. This was my first ever operational tour with the Marines. So first of all, it's like, yes, I've made it. And secondly, oh, you're going to be dressed in American uniforms, using American equipment and vehicles. I'm like some kind of MI6 / James Bond Marine here. So it was a brilliant tour and very excited. So we were there just to go and decapitate the head of Al-Qaeda and the other warring factions. During the days and downtime, we had one paratrooper attached to us, Mark, who came to live with me years later and became best friends. During the day, he was a medic. He was a trauma medic. So during the day, we were invited to go down to the American hospital in Baghdad, called the Cache, to help out. By help out, I mean flirt with the nurses, obviously. So every day, we were on nighttime operations, so we wouldn't get in till 4 a.m., 5 a.m. sometimes. We usually sleep till 11, if we were able to. So me and Mark used to get up early and go down to the hospital to flirt with the nurses.
Yeah. Love the honesty. And,
Well, I mean, good
Welsh man.
Yeah, and drink their French vanilla coffee and use their free internet. It wasn't as well set up these days with phones and stuff. You had to go into a terminal. To do that, we had to drive around an area of the Baghdad called the Green Zone. You know, this was the safe area where all the Western contractors, the media, officials, everyone could move around with a certain amount of security and safety. To move around there, we would dress in civilian clothes and sign out an old battered Iraqi civilian car from water transport and use that just so you didn't, when you were driving around in pairs, you didn't stand out. You just looked like all the other security and contractors just driving around the green zone. And we'd only be armed with a pistol. So we used to go down to the hospital each day and do this. And there were only two routes back from the hospital. So our options for deception of our daily plan, which it was, we were setting patterns, was limited. We'd had an intelligence briefing that in between the dates of the 27th and 29th of September, Al-Qaeda were going to attempt to snatch a Westerner from the Green Zone. We'd been told this a couple of weeks before. All right, didn't pay much attention to it. This one specific day, which happened to be the 28th of September, we were driving back to camp and we got stopped at a checkpoint. And it wasn't a random stop. They identified us. They walked straight out in front of our car and pointed their AK-47s at us. I don't want to go into the whole ins and outs of the story because I guess people have to read buy the book and read it. Of course, we got out of it because I'm still sat here at this moment. But there were five gunmen, Al-Qaeda, who sprung an ambush on us, pointed the AK-47s directly at us. We were only armed with two pistols.
Shit.
And yeah, so at that point, if I told you my thoughts weren't of an orange boiler suit on Al Jazeera when my head been chopped off, I'd be lying, because they were. Yeah, and we had to take action to get out of it.
Shit. There's so many ways I can look at this right now, but for instance, right, so they're in the green zone right now, yeah? How out of all the people to pick, they get you two?
And I talk about this in the book as well, in conclusion afterwards. Well, how exactly, as you said, well, how have they pulled this off? First of all, the guards, there's guards to the Green Zone. There's checkpoints with Iraqi army and Iraqi police. They're corrupt.
Okay.
The country's corrupt from top to bottom. So no matter who you are, you're corrupt. Somebody's got enough money, they can buy your allegiance. And the only way we could think of was also they were on the entrance to the hospital, there were American military guards, but also private guards. A lot of them were Middle Eastern. And to get into the hospital, even though we're dressed in civilian clothing, we'd have to withdraw and unload our pistols for the Americans and show ID. So, of course, these security guards are going British Army, Royal Navy, civilian clothing, unshaven, longish hair, pistols. Well, for starters, they just know we're military because we've got military ID. And clearly, then, they knew our routine. This information has been passed back to this Al-Qaeda kidnap squad. There's two Brits, military, turning up every day in civilian clothing, round about the same time, leaving around about the same time. And that's where we believe they've got the intelligence. And for the actual then stop on us, they must have had somebody watching that entrance, or the actual guard then saying they've just left and they've gone that way, which means it was only two routes back.
We're taking
that route back to the base.
Wow.
That's how we believe
that. That's your conclusion of this situation. And obviously you're still here to tell the story, so
you have to
read the book to finish the other part. But in that situation there, right, you've got, did you say, five gunmen?
Yeah, five. Pinded. So one came out of the woods, just that's how we knew it, they were for us. The traffic was moving, and he walked out from the woods straight in front of our car and pointed straight at us. So it was, and then the others had locked down the roundabout to stop all the other traffic. Well, to try and coordinate this. There's five of them there, yeah.
Wow. What is your emotions like in that moment, right? Because we're all emotion-based. We all try to relieve from emotions, but you're trying to, you know, you talk about the flight, fight, or freeze.
Yeah.
And this is, like, this is a moment.
This is it.
This is flight, fight, or die, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, and it is. And it's a moment that the majority of people on Earth, that fight, flight, or freeze in the deadly form. We all get a little bit, oh, it's an email I don't want to open. But in that kind of form, a lot of people go their whole life without really knowing that, like a bank robbery or somebody breaking into your house, somebody pointing a weapon at you, being in severe danger. So a lot of people go their whole life without knowing what that inbuilt reaction is. Because we all sit there, don't we? Go, well, if I was in a bank robbery and some granny was getting grabbed by the bloke, I'd do something.
Yeah.
Or somebody broke in my house, I'd act this way. Or if an Al-Qaeda gunman pointed a weapon at me in the car, I'd do this. When we go to, like me, oh yeah, if I get into battle one day, this is how I'm going to react with it. But you don't know until it actually happens. There's no way of knowing. And there was two very different reactions getting played out in the front of our car. You had Marks, whose was very urgent and wanted to do something there and then. He was, I wouldn't say panicked, but very in a rush. Right, we need to do something, we need to do something quick. And me, who was the opposite, was saying, right, let's just calm down a minute. Is it a kidnap? Well, are they not got badges? Are they not official? Mm. And he's going, no, they're not. I'm going to put my foot down and go straight through them. I was like, well, don't do that, because he will just open fire. Mm. So whether that was a good reaction for me or not, but as it turned out, the two reactions between us seemed to balance each other out. If we'd have both been in a haste, then maybe something else would have happened. If we both had just been like, yeah, well, let's see what's happened, we might not have done anything, and they would have had us. So my initial reaction, and it did turn out that it wasn't just this, it happened in other instances throughout my career where something like that happened, was just to, right, well, let's just weigh it up. A bit like I said earlier, just measure to just go, well, let's work out what's going on first before we start pushing any buttons and getting panicked about it. So, yeah, maybe with an AK pointed at my head at that moment, I would have thought that I wish I'd gone my life without knowing what my reaction was. But that was my natural reaction, and that was his natural reaction. Luckily, the balance of the two turned out in our favour.
So when you, let's roll forward a couple hours right now and you get back to back to your area. Are you sitting there looking at each other like, what the fuck? Or you like a little, like men deal with a lot of things with humor. Mm. It's very common. Mm. You have a little chuckle to each other, or you're going, what did we just experience? Yeah,
it was bizarre because, as again, I found out in my career, is I dwell on things like that a lot more afterwards. Mm. At the time, it didn't really faze me. It's just happening. I've got to do something about it, and I'm focused on doing it. It's only an afterthought. In hindsight, you look back and go, whoa, that was quite serious. Yeah. This could have happened. Any little thing could have happened to make that whole situation completely different outcome. Mm. And it's afterwards, and you think back and reflect on it. In this particular one, we got back, and we didn't even report it to the higher command when we got back. Wow. We got back to the room, went straight back to the room, told the other lads what I was just told you, and they were like, lads, they just tried to kidnap you. And we were like, yeah, but should we go, get up to the operations room now and report it. Because we were just still dazed by it, running through our heads, what's just happened? Of course. And we got back and we were like, oh, yeah, and we did go and report it. And yeah, it was a serious issue because they then sent patrols out to try and track them down.
Surely then as well, they'd start investigating these people on the gates or people going through, you know, the people. Because a bit of, like you said, you got your conclusion out of this is no one's squeaky clean over there. Mm. So there's a high chance that someone might have been tipped something or heads up.
100%. I mean, we watched it when it all ended and we saw them legging it away. They ran through the checkpoint straight past the armed Iraqi police guards. And you just like, they just let them do that. So they're clearly in cahoots with them.
Wow, man. Is there any other experiences like that where you've had close calls like this or as impactful as that?
Loads of close calls. And one of the most chilling for me was not a direct firefight or direct contact with the enemy. And it was, we'd been out on a mission. We'd gone out by helicopter. We'd been picked up by helicopter. It was an American helicopter. Flown us back to camp. And I'd had a bad feeling about this. They dropped us, when they dropped us off, they dropped us in the wrong place. They picked us up. They'd landed in the wrong place and we had to walk a kilometer to them. Mm. And as I was getting on the ramp, there was just oil flooding everywhere down the ramp of this helicopter. And we had some American Marines attached to us. So I sort of nudged one of them, Jason, said, mate, what's going on here? He was like, it's the American helicopters. He said, you should be worried if there's not oil pissing out everywhere. And I was like, okay. Doesn't happen on a British helicopter.
Mm.
Took us back to camp, dropped us at the wrong end of our runway, and then off we went. Went back to the room, got a shower, got sorted out. And then as I was walking back to the HQ, I heard we had the radio on. It's British Forces Broadcasting Service, BFBS. And it was a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. Not unusual to hear. Heartbreaking, of course. Tragic. And I was like, oh, okay. Got to the ops room, and as I walked in, everyone just sort of looked at me as if I was a ghost. So I was like, all right. And they were like, you're not heard. I said, no. The helicopter we'd just been on dropped us off, went back out to the desert to pick up a group of Afghan soldiers, and then crashed on its way back to Camp Bastion, killed everyone on board.
Shit.
And it's things like that is more chilling to me than a firefight. Because in a firefight, you could do something about
control.
You can affect the outcome of that. Sometimes you can't. It just happens. But once it started, you can still, by your movements, your communications, firing back, you can still affect it, or you can still believe you can affect it in some way. Mm. With that, you're like, what's, and it was a mechanical failure, it wasn't shot down or anything, well, even if it was shot down, there's nothing I could do. You just think, that helicopter had a time ticking on it, until it crashed. And the difference between when you were on it and when you weren't was the difference between life and death. It was ticking down and we just happened to get off it before that time ran out. And and you just think, there'd be nothing I could have done if I was on there at the wrong time to stop it dropping out of the sky.
Wow. That wouldn't you think as well, though, in those moments, they should do mechanical checks quite often? Like, like you said, your gut's telling you now, something's not right here.
Yeah.
But like, you'd think maybe they've upgraded and learned a lot more. What year was this?
2012.
Okay, so not too long ago. Long enough.
I mean, the height of Afghan is, I mean, we'd be flying helicopters for 60, 70 years in warfare.
But if oil's guzzling out of it and, you know, your gut's telling you a few things and you're getting dropped off at the wrong area and you've got to walk a mile on, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're, man, you must count your blessings as well sometimes.
Yeah, it was, yeah. I said that one sticks out. A lot of people expect me to talk about a bullet nearly hitting me, which did happen a few times, but that one is the one I sort of dwell on. I think that was just pure luck.
But do you think as well then, Westy, like, obviously when you're on ground, you got control. Mm. A helicopter, you got zero control. Like, you got, you're hoping the guy who's obviously operating it is the guy who's got a control of how many are on this aircraft, you know.
At the mercy of everything, weather, pilot, somebody on the ground shooting you. The engine, because they could just, engines fail on everything. So, yeah, you're at the mercy of everything else apart, and there's nothing you could do about it.
Yeah, wow. Is it in particular bonds that you had whilst in service that, you know, like, a lot of best mates you pick up in the service, but more importantly, like, times or memories where you can reflect on and go, like, or, you know, I suppose just reflect on in a fond manner as well, not just, like, there was hardship there, like...
Yeah,
losing men as well, like, that's quite a common thing that happens in these times. So, you know, do they teach you these, you know, traumatic events post service?
Yeah, that's got better. Yeah, it's, and it had to, because the statistic, well, it is the statistic now, is more men have killed themselves, or more service people have killed themselves after the Falklands War than died in the actual conflict, which is staggering when you think about it. They went to war, people died, a big conflict, didn't last very long, but I think we lost 255 servicemen in it, and servicemen and women. But more have killed themselves afterwards because of the trauma
from it,
than died in the actual conflict. And Iraq and Afghanistan is a ticking time bomb. That figure will, I think in America it already is.
Wow.
More have killed themselves than died in the conflict. Because a lot of them don't manifest until years and years later, where they do get older and life slows down and they get more time to dwell on it. Because when you're living your life 1,000 miles an hour in the Marines,
you've got no time.
Time to think back on it and sit there. So it'll happen later on. So they did have to get their act together with it. Mm. The problem is, which I found as well after leaving and having a few dark moments, is the understanding of it. And it's such a complex thing, mental health and PTSD. It's such a massive spectrum.
Yeah.
And hard to diagnose. Got a broken leg. There's the x-ray, you got a broken leg.
Yeah.
You got, all right, you're struggling. But what is it? Is it, like, I suffer from hypervigilance, which I identified myself. It's a strand of PTSD. Right. But when you say to somebody, for me anyway, it may be something that's got to change in all of us. If somebody says to me, oh, he's got PTSD, I immediately think classic PTSD symptoms, shaking, nightmares, scared to leave the house. Mm. I always revert back to that for whatever reason, whether it's cultural. Yeah. And it's not. There's so many different forms of it.
Mm.
And how do you treat it? Because misdiagnosis is a big thing as well.
Yeah.
So they have put things in place for it, but it's just, you can't blame anyone for it not being able to stop suicides and people, feeling like they feel, because we're still miles away from learning anything about it.
And the other thing with that as well is the fact that, like, so if you've ever done service, they probably, you know, not saying every doctor does it or GP, but, like, there's probably a pyramid system of, okay, well, he's done this career, okay, boom, we'll put him in this category straight away without actually figuring out the route. Like, there might have been something that happened when you were younger, you experienced that, then when you went into camps or tours, that's just been bottled on top of every other thing aspect you've had. And if you're going at 100 miles per hour, you're not essentially sitting with yourself often, or, like, having time in solitude to actually address this, that, and the other. But I suppose my next question I'm going to go over to now is, how do you go with adrenaline, for instance, right? So I am super interested in this one, because if I was at gunpoint, right, in my life, my adrenaline and adrenal glands and everything we talk about, stress, is at probably at this height. I wouldn't even know how I'd be in that experience, right? So then when you come back to normal things, like, you know, people do a workout or they go for a hike or they, you know, go on a roller coaster that scares the crap out of them.
Gamble,
yeah. Like, is it hard to find like a high where?
Yeah. The Marines wasn't just who I was. I didn't join the Marines, and some people they join the forces young, and that becomes they don't know anything else. I used to come home every weekend, go to the football with the lads I went to school with. I wasn't a different person, different in many ways, like as all of us are in any career. You change and grow.
Yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't as if I was consumed by the Marines and I needed to learn how to be a different person. But you do, I was good at being a Marine. I was good at this within the Marines. So even within the Marines, I went, well, I'm good with weapons. I'm going to go and be a weapons and tactics specialist. You find your way. And so your whole career, you're like, I'm good at this. I enjoy this. And that's who you are.
Yeah.
Learning who you are and becoming that person. And then you get to the end of your career, and then all the things you were working towards to be the best at, I can't do that. I can't jump out of helicopters and kick doors in anymore and escape from Al-Qaeda. And then you go, well, again, like you said, the focus, and I am maybe an Iron Man or something. Well, who am I now? What? In the Marines, there was always something keeping me, pushing me on, motivating me. That's gone now. I've now got to learn what else am I going to find in life that's going to, and it could just be running Iron Man's or hobby. For me, I thought it was going to, well, it is now, the business.
Yeah, of course.
I got the business, going to visit my daughter. So, yeah, it is learning. I thought, I did have it all planned out. Fortunately, the bad time of COVID temporarily took it away. Now it's back on track. So, hard days, people need that. They need to decide, right, I need to learn who I am again and what I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
100%. And I think it is looking forward. If you look back for too long, you're going to fuck your neck up one and you're just going to dwell in there. Yeah. And there's always highlights and there's always negatives to look back on, fond memories. But, I could go on, but I think you always just need to be doing something. For instance, like you hit the nail on the head then regarding being in the Royal Marines. It was actually the identity behind it wasn't, that was what you were doing, right? That was your job role, but the skill sets that you were actually good at were the things that made you enjoy that. Yeah. And I think understanding what it is you're good at and understand what skill sets you naturally have and then enhancing that is a really big beneficial thing. But the other factor is I can definitely relate to this is when I left the sport, you realize that, so people do this thing, right? Where they'll, an easy conversation start. It would be like, oh, how are you doing, mate? You've been on tour lately or have you not? And you instantly talk about this and you think, shit, these people only know me for this person. So you're thinking, shit. Well, I did anyway when I was a rugby player. I still play this year, but my head was I'm in a different perspective of it's not who I'm not defined by the sport anymore. Yeah. But I thought for a long time that, oh shit, these people only like me for these things that I do.
Yeah.
But what you got to realize is it's just an easy conversation them to have. If they're just walking by.
Of course it is, yeah. If they know that's your interest, they can have a conversation about you.
Of course. So it's just these little shifts that we can do as people. But one thing I want to talk about as well, right? And I know we've gone off. One thing about podcasts, we go off topic.
So it should be, though.
Yeah.
It's be natural.
Yeah. It's I'm really enjoying this. But the story about you, mate, becoming an undercover immigrant, is that right?
Yeah, and that's one of the things we did on Tramp Fist.
And explain that. How did this even come about?
Because
when I heard this story, I was like, this guy's next level.
Well, this ties in well with the one we skipped about adrenaline, actually.
Oh, sorry, mate.
So this is good. It's good.
Good memory. Natural
tie-in. Yeah, yeah. It's a benefit, a gift, and a curse sometimes having a good memory. So Tramp Fist. We came about with the adrenaline highs and lows. I'd fallen in my early days in the Marines. My routine was work hard, play hard, bit of a cliche, but it was. We'd go away, I'd be on camp, I'd be doing whatever. I'd bought a house in Swansea, come home for the weekend. Most of my mates, we'd talk in late 20s now, we were getting married, already married, having kids, settled down. They weren't interested in going out to town, getting smashed. We'd maybe go to the football for the afternoon and they'd go home by 8 o'clock. So I'd come home on a weekend, I'd go out on my own. And that's where my lone wolf travel started coming from. I was just sitting in the house on my own all weekend. I got to town. It's bizarre to some people. You could just go, you went out to nightclubs, bars and nightclubs on your own. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So it got into this circle. And then it got to a point 2011, before one of my Afghan tours, they gave us 4 or 5 weeks off before going. It was late autumn. None of my mates could go abroad. I wanted to go away. So I thought, oh, I'm just going to go to America on my own. So I just went, flew into Chicago and did a bit of a tour around San Francisco, around America on my own. And this was, I can identify now, was my need to fill that gap when I wasn't with the Marines. When I was with the Marines, it was around the lads, we were having a laugh, the banter, camaraderie, action, adrenaline, even in training, still jumping out of helicopters and doing dangerous stuff. And it was this downtime then I started to identify I need to fill it with something, because I will just end up just getting drunk in my hometown.
Self-destruct a bit.
Yeah. And which is great. I mean, got on the RAS for 2 weeks and what goes with it. Yeah. I was like, well, let's start finding something else. So traveling became the other something else. Let's go and see a bit of the world on my own as well. And then fast forward to 2014, just about to go on my next Afghanistan tour, or what turned out to be my last and the last Herrick of the Helmand tours when Camp Bastion closed. I was on UK counter-terrorist response. So I was the sergeant as part of the team. So if a plane got hijacked, school got taken over or whatever, of course the police would react, and then like people at SAS would react, and we were attached to the units that would react, black in the black here, all that type of stuff. So we were on call. We had a pager. So what went that was you couldn't leave the country. So they gave us 2 weeks off at Christmas. But I couldn't go abroad now. What I had been doing for a few years, whenever I got time off, even just a weekend in Copenhagen, if I had a weekend off, I'd go. Well, what am I going to do for 2 weeks over Christmas? I'm not married, live on my own.
Yeah,
I'll go and see my mother on Christmas Day and that'll be it. I'll just get hammered in the pubs of Swansea for 2 weeks. So I decided to go and live on the streets of Swansea for a week, homeless. But I didn't, my mate ended up joining me as well. I didn't want to just do it and tell everyone, like reporters and journalists do, or officials, oh, I'm coming to see what it's like being homeless. Because nobody will treat you the same. You won't get the full experience. So we had a cover story. We said, right, we're ex-forces on the streets, which is a very believable story. Because we want the homeless people to treat us naturally, talk to us naturally. We had to beg every day, so we couldn't use our own money. We had to sit there and beg on the streets if we wanted to feed ourselves. And we had to sleep rough because we wanted passers-by to sleep, treat us. And we wanted to access the services and get them to treat us. So we wanted to report on what it's actually like. Wow. Yeah, it's only a week, but we wanted to live it for a week.
100%.
So we did that the first year, really successful. We did a blog every day and raised money for charity. So a year later, we're like, well, we did it. And we said, well, let's do it again next year when we get time off. So we can't do the same because people aren't going to donate to that. Like, we've already done it.
Yeah.
So let's up the ante. So the second year we went, it was hot news at the time, as it is now, the migrant camp in Calais. Well, let's go and live there for a week. And we did that. And the one you're probably talking about is the most latest one, where we went back to the migrant camp.
Mm.
And the third year, we, same rules, but we hitchhiked whilst living homeless. So we started off in Swansea, thumbs out. And whoever, if anyone did pick us up, wherever they were going, we would go. Get out, go homeless for the night, and do the same the next day, thumb out. So we're at the mercy of whoever picked us up. Where are you going, lads? Where are you going? Oh, I'm off to Leeds. Well, Leeds it is, then.
Amazing.
Yeah, we just did that for a week. Brilliant it was. That's the third book. So
wow.
Those first three I've mentioned are the first three Tramp Face books. But I got another two to write. So then the fourth year, we cycled from Swansea to London over 5 days whilst living homeless. So Swansea to Cardiff, locked up the bikes, went homeless for the night, begging, same conditions. Next day, Cardiff to Bristol, et cetera, et cetera. I think it was Swindon, Oxford, Reading, London.
Wow.
Got to London, locked up the bikes, went 2 nights homeless in London. And then on Sunday morning, put our trainers on and ran the London Marathon.
Wow.
Yeah, 7 nights homeless cycling.
I'm so speechless,
that was,
mate.
Yeah, that was.
Was this a spontaneous decision, or was it like, no, this is how it's, we're going to get there, we're going to do the marathon?
Yeah, we planned it, yeah.
Wow,
yeah,
mate.
So, because we had to apply, the charity gave us spots.
That's right.
We didn't get into the ballot, we had to, the charity gave us spots, because we'd raised so much from over the years.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was pre-planned, we'd work it out and then announce it each year. And then the most recent one, we decided to go back to France, We spent a few nights around Paris in the migrant camps on the outskirts. Took part in a Yellow Vest protest. Mm. I got tear gassed. I got a video of it. It's brilliant by the French police. It just me. I got a can of lager in my hand, which I didn't spill or drop, which is...
Priorities.
Big time. And then we went back to Calais, a couple of nights in the migrant camp. And again, just living just in the camps. We've got the videos in tents with the migrants, just living with them.
What was that experience like?
It was bizarre because initially we were really, I'd say scared, but precarious because we didn't, the first time we went there, we didn't know. We were told it's lawless. We don't know who these people are, what's going on. But after a while, you sort of, like any situation, you settle in, you work out, right, these are the bad guys, this is the bad area, these are the do's and don'ts, and get the feel for the ground. But it was interesting as well because it wasn't, I just thought it'd be a collection of migrants, all got the same aim, all clubbing together, all living, singing Kumbaya on the fire, and it wasn't. There's like warring tribes from different countries, and once the sun went down, it was the Wild West. Violence,
really?
Drinking, didn't see anyone actually taking drugs, but we saw the effects of it a few times. So it was a big eye-opener, very interesting. Mm. And we got the other personal stories. We made friends in there as well. We made enemies, people who just hated us and were just bad people. But we befriended a lot of them and got their personal stories. So it was a brilliant experience.
It definitely brings some form of empathy to some of these people, that the situations they're in. You know, some are maybe self-inflicted, but some are legit, like, you poor bugger, you're here.
And that's it. It's not black and white. You get a lot of people look at it from the outside and go, they're illegal migrants trying to get across illegally. And you're right, they are. Mm. And that's it. And then you get the other people go, they're just fleeing from war and they just need help. And you're like, some of them are. But some of them aren't. So it's not just one or the other. Mm. And until you get there, it does put that... And you could be the most hardline person to go, they're all scum or they're all up to no good. Some of them are. And it's illegal. Yeah. And then you go there and you speak to them and you go, right, they're not scum, these ones I'm talking to now. Yeah. They are trying to get across illegally, which I do disagree with. They shouldn't be allowed to. But I do actually feel a bit sorry for them as well because I've spoken to them on a human level.
Of course, man.
So you do get it's like any walk of life, good people and bad people. Until you go there and put yourself in the middle of it, you then work out which ones are which.
That's an interesting one you said this. So when I was in Australia, at one stage I was working for like a demolition company and we got asked, would you like to work on like a refugee island? I was like, yeah, sure. It was like a week away in a little country called Nauru. So you've got Papua New Guinea, just to the right of it, I think it's like New Caledonia, and then Nauru, a little island. Mm. Literally, you could drive it in under an hour, the city. So basically, like, all of these asylum seekers and refugees were all in the middle of the island, like these cabins, we'd call them then. Mm. And everyone else, locals, would just live along the water, the ocean.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we were there removing these roof sheets from this power plant, and they said to us, right, if you want to work with us, like, if the locals want to work with us, they can labor for you or something like that at the time. We were like, sure, no worries. Like, we didn't have anything connected to how they were getting paid, but they were going to get paid. I don't know. In the end, I found out they were only getting like $1 or $2 an hour, which was terrible considering what we were getting. Anyway, not many of the locals could handle the work. They would rock up late, piss off early. But then they offered it to the asylum seekers then. Do you want to help? Do you want to work? And some of them would be like, yeah. So anyway, it was one guy, and I talk about this story when I do talks. His name's Saji. And he was either from Bangladesh or Pakistan, one of them, right? Mm. And every morning, right, he used to come into work, happy, chirpy. Mm. Hey, boys, how you doing? Like, blah, blah, blah. And you started building this relationship. I spent 10 hours, 12-hour days with him for a week. By the end of the week, I got to know him pretty well.
Yeah.
So one day in particular... I was walking into work and he was just sitting there on the side of the road, but he had his eyes closed and now I know he was meditating. Mm. So I was curious about this now, and a lot of the things I picked up was from this guy. And I remember one day I was like, Saji, you are always happy. What is going on? Like, what's the crack? Why are you here? And he was like, well, 3 years ago I was in an island in my hometown and my village got people come through these, I don't know what they were, but they shot up the whole village. And they shot his mum and dad in front of him. Instantly then my heart's gone, and they turned the gun towards him and said, "You either piss off out of you, or you're getting done too." So he just ran, got out of the village, got on a boat, and thought, "I've just got to fled this country." And he was going on a boat to Australia, into Melbourne. Yeah. And like the offshore police, like they captured the boat, sent them to Nauru. So he's telling me a story, right? And he's experienced his mum and dad dying in front of him. He's just trying to do what's right, trying to get out of the country. I was bawling my eyes out hearing this. But the fact that he was still happy, he was very present, showing a lot of gratitude. And at that stage in my life, I was very much playing the victim card and why me, why like the outcomes of my life of injuries or something. Yeah. And then my whole perspective and shifted and go, fuck, you know what? Life could be so much worse. This guy's been in this country for 3-4 years now. And he brought the best thing about it, like he rocked up on 10, but he was there every morning on the dot, offering you tea, offering you water. In the end, I gave him half my clothes. I felt that bad.
It embarrasses you sometimes, isn't it? Somebody could be that positive after everything that's happened to him. It does. You embarrass it. You think, well, what have I got to moan about?
Exactly that. But taught me so much, and probably the best thing that I really needed at that stage in my life. But I want to shift the story now back to you, mate, and this. You know, you coming from north of France over on a dinghy.
Yeah.
How did this experience or this journey happen?
Yeah. So the most recent trip to the camp was for this. So the first time we went there, we thought, oh, what's the chance of getting across on the back of a lorry, whatever? It's trust me, it's near impossible now. That's why they come across in boats. So we were struggling after the high of the marathon tramp face. It was amazing. Great week, great stories and great accomplishment. So we're like, oh, we're going to top this. We're going to have to go like homeless on the moon or something. Mm. And Paul, who used to do it with me, fortunately died 2 years ago, in a freak paddleboard accident in West Wales.
Wow. How old was Paul?
42 he would have been. Yeah.
Shit, young.
2 years ago, yeah.
Sorry,
Yeah. And he always had these brilliant ideas. And he's like, I know how we can top it. He said, you know how we failed to get across last time? He said, they're coming across on boats now. It's hot topic. So again, it's topical. People are going to be interested in it and read our stories and donate. Mm. So it's going to be good for that aspect. And he said, "And we've got something to lay to rest here. We failed to get across. Let's get across." So he said, let's do it in a dinghy. So again, my reaction was, that's mental and dangerous and everything else that goes with it. Bear Grylls actually, to my face, called me mental for doing this. I met him when I was in the Marines. He's honorary colonel in the Marines. Yeah,
wow.
He's read the books, sent me an email the other week. And
he called you mental.
I told him, and this is, Bear Grylls, because like, he was like, oh, so what kind of support boat did you have with you and like contacts and everything? Because he obviously does when he's doing TV.
Of course.
I was like, well, none, Bear. It's just me and my mate in a boat on the English Channel. And he was like, nothing. He was like, that's mental.
Wow. Did you have any moments, Westy, where like waves are hitting you or and you're like, we're gonna flip this little dinghy soon?
Yeah,
a lot of those moments.
Yeah, the start was
obviously was when you were just trying to break
surf. Yeah, it wasn't too bad in the middle, in the luckily because it was dark when the sun came up and we were getting closer to Kent. We got videos of it. You can see in the videos like where pointing it at us and the waves are like coming up, rising up behind us. So it was choppy. And
Oh mate, I would have been counting my blessings there, mate.
Yeah, we got arrested on suspicion of human trafficking.
Yeah. because of the doll.
Well, no, what we didn't know at the time until they got us back to the station and the custody sergeant asked them to explain why we should be detained was 5 minutes before we landed. Two actual migrant boats had landed just down the beach from us, and they'd caught them.
Captured them.
And the drivers of the boats, believe it or not, were ex-military. So I think they don't know, obviously I don't know the exact facts of it. I know they were ex-military because they explained it to the custody sergeant. So whether they were working for one of these no borders agencies who believe everyone should be allowed to go everywhere, like an activist group, or whether they were paid with the traffickers because they were boat drivers.
Yeah, wow.
So, of course, these coppers are like, what do you do for a living to me? I'm still serving at the time, Royal Marines. What do you do, Paul? I work in a steelworks. How do you know each other? Oh, we joined the military together. All right, two and two together. You must be with those other boats.
Mm.
Facilitating it somehow. We didn't have any actual migrants with us, but they were like, well, perhaps they were the shadow boats for them, warning them. Or
wow.
So yeah, we got arrested. It's funny because when they were interviewing me, the National Crime Agency, they were playing our videos that we'd taken on the way up. Because I was like, just get my phone out. There's videos on it. You can see we haven't got any migrants, apart from Gary. And by the end of it, they got so used to Gary, they were like talking through the videos for the benefit of the tape in the interview. And he's like, I can see Mr. West in front of the boat. I can see Mr. O'Dwyer driving it. There's no other boats around them. Gary's in the front, getting his head down. They were talking about him as if he was an actual human being.
Yeah. He's a blow-up doll, man.
Brilliant.
Oh, that's fair play to you, mate. That, and alone, that journey, that story. Yeah. You obviously love it, like, again, it comes back to adrenaline rushes as well.
Yeah, it is. It's, I could just look back. It's not like, oh, I need to. Yeah. It's just inbuilt in me now. It's just like, if I get any downtime.
Yeah.
That's why I struggled so much with the COVID thing. Is I got to go and do something. Doesn't have to be adrenaline fueled to the max. Like I said, just traveling, something that's going to perk me and keep me occupied.
Yeah. So, for instance, for now, then, for someone who's experienced intense and demanding situations, you know, how do you prioritize self-care and maintain your mental and, you know, emotional well-being?
Difficult. I do let it slip at times, and I'll be honest with that. Except you say, oh, I've got the perfect life, and I got a lot to focus me. I got the business, charity, my daughter in the States, books, audio books, loads going on. And sometimes it's hard because even though I've got loads of stuff to do, I can find myself, I'll go into the business and I'll just sit in that office and I've been there a few hours and I'll be like, what have I done? I haven't done anything because the motivation levels have just gone. So fitness is a massive one for me, which again, with the COVID thing, I wasn't going out for a run. The gyms were closed. And as we said before, there was no emphasis to it. It's like, well, when I'm in the Marines, if you don't keep up your running, you're in trouble when you go back to work. Then I was like, well, what's going to happen? So I allowed my motivation levels to drop. So having a routine and fitness has to be part of it for me. The minute's really good. I go into the business early. I open up for the guys. Staff come in at 11 and I go straight to the gym where technically it should be quiet because everyone should be in work. And it generally is. And then early on in the day, I've got that. I mean, I've got that that buzz, tick that box. And always having, my friend hit the nail years ago, I had a girlfriend and I broke my collarbone and she was moaning to it. She worked with him. And she said, I went around earlier. He's turned his living room or his dining room into a sports bar. He's up a ladder stapling sports jerseys to the ceiling. He's got a broken collarbone. And my mate just turned around and said, that's Westy. He's got to have something to do.
Yeah.
He's got to have a project. Doesn't matter what it is, but he's got to have a project. You want to have him sat in the house with a broken collarbone. Because he needs a project. And that's it. It sounds very straightforward and basic, but that's it for me, really. Just need...
Working towards something.
Yeah.
How, for instance, then, you know, you talk about when you left the Royal Marines and you hit COVID. How bad did it get for you then coming out the other end, you know, just generally like really shit time as well, hitting COVID as well, starting up a business. And there's so many, like reflecting on it, listening to this journey, like it's understandable that you'd hit the, you know, a rut there.
Yeah, I was in hospital. I dragged myself into hospital and should have died. I went to hospital a few times because it got that bad. And on one instance, they put me in there. I found it torturous just being in these big wards. And it wasn't just for wards of people like me. There was somebody with a ruptured spleen or broken legs and people screaming in agony all around me. And obviously, I'm going to come down from the booze. I didn't do drugs or anything. It was just hard booze, whiskey. It was just torturous to me. And then it's one time I escaped, got out of there. So I didn't have a bank card on me. I somehow worked out how to get Apple Pay on my phone. I'd never had it before. I went looking for somewhere to buy a drink. And Paul, a Trampfist friend, summed it up when everyone found out I'd done this. He said, there's Stubborn and then there's Westy. And he said, if he wants to go and get a drink, even though he's in hospital, he'll figure out a way of getting it.
Wow.
And I did. Managed to get to a shop, bottle of gin, necked it. My plan was to go back to hospital. I did end up going back, but not in the way I thought. I'll just drink this. I just wanted a drink just to calm me down. I'll go back to hospital and then they can continue treating me.
Yeah.
And I collapsed in a ditch And luckily a nurse, because it wasn't that far from the hospital, was walking into work, found me. I'd been on the phone to my friends. The phone was still live, so they tell me now they could hear the nurse trying to bring me round. And I was unresponsive, and she couldn't bring me round. She obviously, I can't remember any of this, but got an ambulance. They managed to haul me in, and I woke up, God knows, a day or so later from a coma, all pipes and everything inside me, in me, on me. And the nurse, when I woke up, they had one just sat on me, watching me the whole time, called one of the other nurses over. They said they were so relieved. They couldn't believe that I'd woke up, because they didn't think, they thought he's not gonna wake up. Mm. So that's how bad it got during COVID. Pretty bad. But like everything, it's, I can't change it now. It happened.
Yeah, it's no point dwelling on it. But it's
yeah, a lot of that, I didn't die or cause any serious damage, is now a benefit, because now I can look back at it and everything, learn from it. And a lot of ways, my relationship with booze has benefited from that.
Yeah, I was about to say, like running a bar, and you know, it's like devil's advocate, it's right in front of you then. So how have you gone, how has that helped?
And a lot of, because I had the bar at the time when I was doing this, and a lot of then specialists were going, what hope has he got? He owns a bar. But one of them hit the nail on the head perfectly to me. A guy called Steve, he'd been in addiction for 20 odd years, and he'd seen every type of addiction. So drugs, smoking, gambling, drinking, and every form of it within them. And he said to me, he said, Westy, he said, people have already put a label on you.
Yeah.
He said, you've probably put it on yourself because of what you've heard in popular culture, whatever, alcoholic.
Yeah.
And he said, let me tell you right now, after 20 odd years experience, you are not an alcoholic. And I was stunned, because that's what everyone was saying, you're an alcoholic. And I was like, okay. And he said, I'll tell you why. He said, you're a week out of hospital now.
Yeah.
He said, one, you've turned up. It was 3 in the afternoon. One, you've turned up. Two, you sat there, not drunk or wanting to drink. And three, you're not physically shaking because you haven't had a drink for a week or today.
Yeah.
He said, if you're an alcoholic, one of those wouldn't have been able to happen. Either not turned up because you'd be drunk, you'd be sat there drunk because you had a drink today, or you'd be physically shaking because you've not had one to try to come to this meeting. He said, you're a binge drinker.
Yeah.
He said, you can go in between those gaps of COVID. I'd come right again. I'd go to hospital. I'd spend 2-3 months training.
You're good.
Yeah, fine. Not drinking, whatever. And then I'd fall off a cliff. He said, that's not alcoholic. Can't do that. They can't just, because he said, you decide. You went to hospital. Yeah, okay. But then you came out and you said, well, I'm not going to drink now. Mm. Alcoholic can't do that.
Yeah.
You need to be forcibly brought off it and given constant medication and medical and mental assistance. He said, you're a binge drinker. You can just click your fingers and stop. When you're embroiled in it and it's going too far, you can't stop because you're in it and you just need to keep drinking. He said, but once you do stop, you can just not think about it. And it's like that with a bar. And he said, everyone's saying, what chances he got? He said, but I know loads of people who own bars and didn't drink. And that's the case now. I'll have a half now and again.
Nice.
Or if we get a new craft, because it's craft beer bar, if we get a new beer in, I'll have a little taste. But as opposed to getting drunk, I don't.
Mm.
So I don't know about the relationship with alcohol. If that hadn't happened, I'd still be in the routine now that I was in the Marines. In fact, worse. Because in the Marines, you have a heavy weekend, you've got to stop because you've got to go back to camp and be a Marine. Camp.
Yeah.
Whereas I own in a bar, if that all had happened, it'd be like, I have a heavy weekend, just keep going because I'm in a bar. And it's the one job in the world where you won't get judged.
Yeah.
You walked into a bar and I was stood behind there having a pint, working there. You're on bat an eyelid. Like, of course he's having a pint. He works in a bar.
Yeah, makes sense.
So if that hadn't have happened, I'd still be on that course of getting smashed every weekend, drinking throughout the week. And there'd always be an excuse. Owning a bar, every day somebody comes in, I know, or I haven't seen for a while, or the toilets are blocked, I spend an hour doing them, I'm having a pint.
It'd
be an excuse every single day to have a pint. And if your mindset is that you drink occasionally, you'll drink all the time.
Yeah.
Because there'll always be an excuse to do it. So in a lot of ways, because there wasn't any permanent damage from it, it's a good thing because my relationship with alcohol now is
good.
Not like it was in the Marines. So
it's interesting to say it because, again, similar concepts to rugby. Mm. You wouldn't drink half of the year because of training.
Yeah.
But whenever you get after a game, you celebrate. Everyone gets on the beers.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, one thing we do in most teams, you do like long weekend camp. So in pre-season, in, I remember in Australia, we went out to like this bush area. You had to bring your own tent and we would train for 2 days straight. But it would be very like, all right, kayak, double up, kayak in this like dam, over to the mountains, climb the mountains, get up to the top. Yeah, you'd love it, mate. Oh, it was unbelievable. You come back down, kayak again, run 10K, finish up. And then we'd be like, you know, barbecue, or we'd do some rugby skills as well with it. Good fun, right?
Yeah, and you're not even thinking about drink when you do it. Same with the Marines. We go away on our little trips, we didn't even think about it, but then...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So then anyway, with the next day there, I remember it was like, well, not even the next day. We're all in our tent. It's hot as shit. It's in middle of summer of Australia now. And the guy just gets a alarm, foghorn just goes off, wakes up the whole camp at 1 a.m. morning. All right, everyone get up, get some logs, run up the hills with logs. All right, back to bed. Just testing us, right?
Yeah.
So you'll spend the next full day now training again. End of that, then you finished. All right, boys, barbecue's on for you. Have some beers. Everyone gets absolutely shit-faced. And it's the same concept again of yourself.
Exactly the same.
So you work hard together, you play hard, and you party hard. Yeah. But when that's out of life and you've got this downtime, what do you
talk? Where does it end?
Yeah, exactly. You've got no thing.
There's no log run to stop you drinking.
Of course. So when you talk a lot, I can connect and understand. And yeah, man, like from my perspective, it makes sense. And I can see your journey and, you know, where you are right now. So how many years have you had the pub since COVID? So that's three?
August 2019. I bought it 5 months before COVID. Worst time ever, yeah. All my good luck in the Marines, not getting kidnapped, not getting shot, not getting dropped out of the sky, the helicopter just came crashing back when COVID hit.
And, you know, how's life been for you since then?
It's got a lot better. This last year's only really seen some stability coming back.
Good.
Up until then, even when we were allowed to open after COVID, staff would come and go. It's casual.
Yeah.
Nobody's joining to work in a bar for the rest of their life as a dream job. And so I'd end up working 12 hours a day on the bar, as well as trying to do all the back office stuff, running it. There was no life.
Yeah.
It wasn't at all. It was, if I'd been somebody, and I say to a lot of my mates, you wouldn't have been able to do it. Not because, oh, I'm special, Superman. They're married and got kids.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have been able
legit
to do that.
Wouldn't.
But because I lived on my own, my daughter lives in America, I could, because I was a loser. I didn't have a life anyway. It was nothing. I didn't have to answer to anyone if I came home at midnight after working in the bar all day. So it was relentless and there was no life. And, you know, like going back to the Marine stuff, the only thing that kept me going was, of course, I didn't want to live my life like that. But in my mind is, like in Marines, there's an end goal here.
Yeah.
It's not going to be like this all the time. Like when you're in recruit training and it's the worst ever, you tell yourself, it's not always going to be like this.
Yeah, yeah.
At some point I'm going to pass. I'm going to go and do exciting stuff, more exciting stuff. And it was the same with the bar. It's just telling myself, right, you've got to do this now. Otherwise, you're not going to get where you want. And what I wanted was what I've got now. I can drive to Manchester to be on a podcast whenever I want, because I'm the boss. And go to America whenever I want.
Freedom.
Going again next week. Yeah, so when this is over, I've got the freedom to do. There's obviously some limitations because you run a business, but I'm my boss. If I want a week off to do this, if I want to go to the gym at lunchtime,
I can go
to the gym at lunchtime. And that was what drove me through all that, was the end goal of, it's not always going to be like it is now.
Yeah.
At some point, I'm going to be my own boss. And I could have jacked it in and there'd be no shame in that because nobody could see COVID coming, a new business.
Of course.
And everyone's saying to me, it's doomed. And again, the stubbornness kicked in then. Yeah. I was like, oh, is it now? We'll see. I know a lot of people say, how did you get through COVID and the energy crisis? What's the secret? I said, there's no sort of inside industry secret, stubbornness.
Yeah, yeah.
That was it. Everyone told me it was going to fail, and I kept going. And I did want to go and get a 9-to-5.
I get that.
Why I got the business. When I was saving up for years in the Marines, because when I left, eventually I wanted to go into it. It didn't have to be a bar. It was just the opportunity that came up at that time. But I'd been saving and saving some opportunity to be my own boss and have the ability to control my life and master my own destiny, as they say.
I love that. No, I really like that. And I think that's one thing for myself. I don't want to do a 9-to-5 for someone else. Yeah. I want to do my own thing and create my own structure. Yeah, you might do
it. It's hard.
It is.
It's worth it.
But it's you know what I've learned on this journey is you learn a lot about yourself.
Oh, big time.
You're not working for someone else. You got to be self-disciplined in what you do. you've got to understand if you don't put the work in, no one else is going to do it. And it's, for me, it's key in life and realizing that there's only one person who's going to get you out of this hole, and that's you.
Yeah, and that's one of the bits of advice I do give in business is what you got to get into your head very early on is, for a business like mine and yourself, you got to get into your head that nobody is going to care as even a fraction as much about this business as you.
Yeah,
you'll get people who care about it more than others and care about it to a satisfactory level, but nobody's going to ever come anywhere close to it. And you got to get that out of your head, because if you don't, you're going to get upset every single day.
Yeah.
You're going to get let down every single day. So you've got to get that way off.
Well, man, look, one of my good friends who kind of connect us together, Jake, he met in your bar.
Yeah.
And he told me a little story, and he said, ask him to share it. And this is about your bike getting stolen.
Yeah, that's right.
What happened?
So we've taken on bike hire now from the bar and servicing and repairs, just to add another string. So I bought a fleet of bikes, all brand new, earlier in the year, to hire out. So I was using them myself then to cycle back in and out when I needed to. So one morning I'd cycled in, and the business is set up. It's got two shutters at the front where the entrances there are then. So to get in, to open up, you've got to go in the back door. Mm. I've got a bike rack outside, so I'd usually come in, lock up the bike, even though it's 40 seconds from walking around the back to getting in the back door, and then come and open the shutters. So this one morning, I'd forgotten my bike lock. So I'll just park it here, 40 seconds.
Yeah.
Surely it's going to be fine. Walked around. By the time I'd walked around and got into the business, I could see through the shutters, somebody, it's the centre of town, it's the thoroughfare from where the sort of dossers hang around. I could see somebody pulling it off the bike rack to head off. So, of course, I've only got like the shutter halfway up now. So I just left it enough for me to duck under it. But the door's locked, so now I'm trying to unlock it. Eventually, I got it all on CCTV as well, with me legging it out after, and I'm like, live for Christie. I think I am anyway. And get the door unlocked, and I run out. So I look right up the road, and he made a couple of mistakes, this guy. Well, his first one was stealing an ex-Marine's mountain bike. and he just is a junction a bit further up. If he'd gone right, he'd have been completely out of sight to me, down the hill and gone. There's no way I wouldn't have been able to see which way he went, and he'd have been, he's on a bike. He'd gone left, and I just saw a snapshot of him go past the building left. Right, here's a chance. So I tear off after him, sprinting. Not as fit as I was when I was in the Marines, blowing out of my hoop within about 300 metres. So I get round a couple of bends, and I can see him on a long stretch of road. The other good thing was he didn't know I was chasing him. So he's just sauntering. Yeah, if he puts his foot down on a bike on a long stretch, I'm not going to catch him. Mm. No way. So luckily he didn't know I was coming after him. So I'm sprinting up this road. Well, I'm not sprinting, but I'm running up this road. I can still see him. He gets to another bend and goes right towards where our train station is. So I'm flagging now. I thought, right, don't give up. Just get to that corner. Mm. If you can't see him, that's it. Game's up. You're knackered. You can't see him. It's done. Got to the corner. And again, I could still see him sauntering towards here. There was a car park, one of the multi-story car parks opposite. I can still see him. So I'm sprinting across the road, through all the traffic, all beeping at me. And the car park that he was coming in from, it's the top of it. It then goes down. Yeah. So he's coming in from the top level of it. And the car park goes down and comes out at a lower street level, the other side. So as I'm running across, I see him going in. And I'm like, well, he's got to go down the route that the cars take now, which is the long route, if I can find the stairs. Luckily, the stairs were on the nearer side to where I was entering. So straight in, bounded down the stairs. Got out the bottom just as he was coming around the last bend of the car park. So I just ran out. Obviously got my pose in front of him, a bit like you boys ready for a rugby tackle. And his eyes just went wide. He knew straight away. Why is it a bloke stood in front ready to tackle me when I've just robbed a bike? He identified it straight away and slammed on the brakes, put his hands up. And like everybody afterwards, oh, did he kick his head in? Like, well, obviously not, because he's cold blood now.
Yeah.
If he'd have tried to get away, I could have tackled him and, given him a dig or whatever to restrain him. But it's cold blood now. Plus, there was two girls that already started filming it. You know, it's like these days. They had their phones up. You just robbed that bike. They were going to him.
Yeah.
So I was like, no, because if I hit him now, it's assault, isn't it? It's cold blood. He's not attacking me.
Yeah.
So, and he just gave up. And I was just, it's a good job he didn't struggle because I was knackered. He probably would have kicked my head in. So I was quite relieved that he'd given up. And he just saw, so I obviously gave him a few stern words. Yeah. And he tried some excuse about, oh, I thought it was my friend's bike, whatever. And it. So yeah, yeah. I sort of gave him a good talking to. Grabbed the bike back off him. He was like, yeah, no worries, sorry, mate. And then it was a comical moment after it then, where everything, it calmed down. Like, I got the bike back, there's no trouble. And he just went, hang on a minute, have you just chased me from where I've stolen this from? And it's a good nearly a mile by the time he's got there. I went, yeah. He went, you must be fit. How do you manage that? I said, well, I was in the Marines for 17 years, mate. He went, well, that makes sense.
He's picked the wrong person. Oh,
Said, that makes sense. He said, I'll tell the lads. I said, yeah, make sure you tell them. They can rob my bikes. They can try, but I'll come after them. I won't catch you all, but I will catch some of you. Mate, and then we just walked off together then. It was comical, mate. Yeah.
Wow. That's yeah. I can't believe it. He's probably like, of all people to take a bike off.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And he was stunned. You can see in his face. He was just like, hang on a minute. He just couldn't believe that I'd chased him from where he took it and caught him.
Yeah. Wow, man. That's a hell of a story. And that's probably your stubbornness, a good factor of your stubbornness, giving up.
100%. Yeah. I was like, that bike's brand new. And I'm not letting I'm not letting him, the principal as well, I'm not letting him have that.
It's the principal.
And I would have beaten myself up because I didn't lock it.
Yeah.
But you think, what's it? 40 seconds.
Yeah.
That's all it took for him to grab that on his way.
Well, man, look, last question I want to ask you is, what advice would you give to someone who's just about to start their journey in the Marines?
There's obviously a lot of advice I could, but we'd be here for a while. The biggest one would have to be off from my own personal experience. I could give them loads of sound bites and promotional speeches, but it's got to be that end goal is... I saw so many lads who joined at the same time as me. They were fit. They had a flair for it. They were good at being a Marine. They had a natural ability. And they had the toughness. But they were young. And again, they got distracted by thinking this 8 months of basic training is what it was going to be like for the rest of their time in the Marines.
Wow.
They couldn't see. They didn't have the foresight to see ahead and go, no, this is just the building blocks. This is to see if we've got what it takes to have the life that they're going to offer us. So I'd say think ahead. And when you do think, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life, it's not going to be like that. Some of it you are going to have to do for the rest of your life,
yeah,
but not to that extreme, austere, tough conditions. Mm. It's going to get better. And the life you can get, and then another bit of advice, if you do get past training, think about your career and think about a lot of guys. Staggers me. They pass commando training, they go through all that 8 months, get the Green Beret, elite, and they put in to go and be a driver or a clerk. And you're like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You could have done that in the army.
Yeah.
Have you not joined to now go and do what they've been kicking their asses to do for the last 8 months? Is have a think about what I did from the start. I want weapons and tactics because I know they're going to go to Iraq, they're going to go to Afghanistan, the Arctic, the jungle. I did my parachuting course. So they're gonna send these type of blokes. I'm not gonna send a driver on a parachuting course.
Yeah,
they're not gonna send them on a jungle instructor's course. No. So have the foresight to know that training isn't always gonna be like it, and then have a think about when you get past training. Well, if I am gonna make a career for this, some guys just want to do the basic, say they're a Marine and get out, or have a little taste of it and then go on. If you are gonna stick to it, have a little think ahead about what life you want in the Marines and opportunities you want.
Wow, man, some really top end advice. Not just that, but I think a lot of people can listen to this. Man, one last thing I always ask my guests before we wrap up is just, what are you grateful for?
Tough one. My limbs still being intact after after all my tours. At the minute, it's my daughter. Talking about physical things, and it was a lot of theoretical things you could be grateful for, and but physical things actually involved in my life at the minute. It's my daughter and being able to see her.
Awesome. Just so listeners can find out about your books and stuff, do you want to promote the four books?
So we got the three Tramp Face ones, the trilogy. soon to be five. Well, I want to get my act together and write them. So the Tramface Homeless by Choice, the first one, Homeless in Swansea. Tramface Calais, it's our trip to the migrant camp. Tramface Hitchhike, it's the one hitchhiking around the UK. And then my fourth, latest one is called Never Above, Never Below, An Adventurous Pursuit of War, Escape and Darkness, which covers the stories that we've, some of the ones we touched on, especially the darkness, the end. They're all out there on Amazon. You can get in touch with me if you can on social media and everything, Lee West, and you can get one from me signed. If you send me a message, I can post them out. But they're all on Amazon. The latest one was number one bestseller up until a few days ago. Facebook cut my ads and I was dropped to number two, unfortunately. And, disaster. Wow. So that one's been selling really well. Brilliant comments and feedback, because they're hot topics, yeah. Mental health, but war.
Yeah,
and, yeah. And I was just fortunate enough that the stories, I don't say, oh, I'm a great writer, that's always number one, is the stories that happened to me, and I'm alive to tell them. It's just fortunate that the stories in there are really interesting stories, just because they happened to me. So those are the four books, and you can get them. The author name's L.G. West.
L.G. West.
Don't ask me what the G stands for. It's Gordon. But, yeah, so the L.G. West, and you'll find them on Amazon. And
awesome. Well, man, thank you so much. I'm grateful for you coming up today. And,
yeah, cheers, Ollie. I loved it, mate.
Sharing your stories and just being in your presence, mate, it means really a lot to me. And, yeah, I'm really grateful for what you've done, not just for our country, but just, like, the lessons you just taught myself and many others. So.
Cheers, mate. Yeah, and I love the rugby stuff, man. I'm gonna have to grill you on that at some point.
Yeah, mate, we'll have a chat plenty of times. I'm actually going to come down in November, check out the pub, and go get some food and that whatnot. But thank you so much.
Sweet. Cheers, mate. Don't just talk it, walk it. Gleaming, mate. Walk it only. Don't just talk it, walk it.